Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Enterprise, BUS 100, Section 8 for Spring Semester 2011. Special Lecture 1, delivered on February 15, 2011. The title of this lecture is Business Entities.
Today, business entities. The human activity of enterprise has a long, long history, possibly going back to before there were even humans as a Homo sapiens sapiens subspecies. We know trade, that is, commerce, was occurring in ancient societies before you could argue that there was even civilization. People bartered for goods. People traveled with goods to sell to people in other places and then bring back stuff. In this part of the country, in fact, we know that there was, in the time of the Native Americans in prehistory, there was a trade route that went through this part of the country from the south, southwest, southeast, up into the Dakotas, where merchandise was taken and traded for other merchandise, which was brought, taken back south or whatever. How do we know this? Because we see things in parts of the country that couldn't have been made there. They couldn't have been made anywhere near there. But we know that they were made someplace else. So lo and behold, there must have been an active trade of some kind going on. And it wasn't just random. It was planned, it was probably seasonal or yearly or something like that. So the human enterprise of the human activity of business has been around for a very long time. And in fact, most of you have been in business in one way or another in your lives. I would say probably somehow, somewhere along the way, you have earned money. Haven't you earned money some way, sometime in your life?
Yes,
you have. And most of you did. Now, you probably did this without thinking, well, I'm a business person, No, you did it because you wanted to make money. That's obvious. You didn't do it in a formal fashion, but that does not diminish at all the fact that you were a business person. The most common kind of business in entity in the United States, and in fact in the world, I would dare say, is the activity of the individual simply doing something for money or for something of value, something else of value. If one person just engages in business, that is a sole proprietorship. The sole proprietor is a one-person show. The sole proprietor is all at risk. You take all of the risk to yourself, and you garner all of the profit, if there is any profit to be made in your business. You own a truck, and you haul people's stuff around, and you make some money. And so, okay, so how much do I owe you? $40. $40, are you out of your mind? Okay, fine, $40. Okay, do you take checks? Okay, good. I used to go out with a Czechoslovakian girl. Her parents said no because, my parents said no because they don't accept checks. That was a joke. Sorry. The hell with this audience. Okay. Here we go. Okay, you know, you see, you're going to take checks. Well, to whom do I make this check? To you, okay? I could make it to you personally. I could write you a check. Or you might get fancy and say, well, the name of my company is One Guy and His Truck. Okay, Now, in either case, but especially in the second case, you have actually created a DBA, a doing business as. Now, formally, you probably would have to register this as a fictitious name, and that kind of registration occurs at the state level. Now, in this state, by the way, they don't call it a fictitious name. They call it an assumed name. And interestingly enough, in this state, it's not even at the state level. I was a little surprised. I've got a couple of DBAs that I use out in this part of the country. And you'll hear one in the podcast of this lecture at the very beginning, Dark Wraith Publishing. And it's just an assumed name. Out here in this state, if you want to create an assumed name and lock it so that it belongs to you, you go through a process at the county level where you apply for the control of the name. You don't have to be a corporation or anything like that. It's just an assumed name. And then they say, okay, now you have to publish in a legitimate newspaper of some kind of publication, that you are going to use this name. And if no one challenges you within a certain period of time, no one challenges that, then that newspaper will send you back, okay, he has had this ad here for a certain number of weeks, and now you can take this back to the county, and they show, okay, I've registered, I've made my application, here's the newspaper saying that I published it, you didn't hear any nonsense about how I was stealing someone's name, therefore, it's mine. And surprisingly, this was a little bit unusual. The county sent me a really nice certificate on hard stock paper naming my DBA, saying this is yours and you get to have it. And so now I have lock control. It's not as good as a trademark or a copyright or anything like that, but it's a way by which you can control that. One guy and his truck is now yours. And you can proudly make t-shirts, bumper stickers, indeed refrigerator magnets, and hand them out to people. The sole proprietor is the ultimate freedom, to the extent that you don't have to jump through hoops. You don't have to explain yourself to any other owners, to anyone else. It's all yours. You're in control. Here's the downside of that. It is an awful lot like work. Because if you are really serious about what you're doing, you're going to have to keep records. And worse than that, one day while you're making some good money with your truck and you pull into this really nice neighborhood and you pull up to this one nice house where you're going to move some furniture and you run over their dog. Well, now this happened to be one of those expensive kinds of dogs. And now you didn't kill it, but I mean the dog is really pissed. You know, you ran over its foot. Okay? So now they are going to sue you. Now what that means is that you are in the line of fire. If they win, they can take your truck, your business assets. And if that's not enough to pay for Fido getting fixed and getting a new leg and all that kind of stuff, well, they're just going to keep coming after you and your personal assets, your personal stuff. Your clothes, your computer, indeed your velvet paintings of Elvis. They'll take them all if they have to. You are all at risk if anything happens. That's the danger of a sole proprietorship. On the one hand, you have a great deal of freedom, and you get to keep all the money after your expenses, and you report it as ordinary income. But then at the same time, you can get your clock cleaned personally, everything you own, because there is no company there. You are the company. You might be acting through your own name, you might be acting through a DBA, but it is you. That's why business life, I have formed corporations. I've done a couple of partnerships, which is next on the list. And I have done DBAs. I tend to do DBAs if the probability is very low of a liability exposure. That's why in publishing, I am pretty safe. I've gotten threats of lawsuits and all of that. And it's one of the things you just send back, they threaten you with a lawsuit. And I know, yeah, if they won, they could wipe me out personally. But I also know that in my business, I can say a lot of things and I won't get in trouble. So I send them back a very courteous, formal business letter that starts with, "Dear Bite Me." That's a sole proprietorship. The next form of organization is a partnership. Now, a general partnership is very similar to a sole proprietorship, except that it is two people. The two of you have a catering business. You just go and get food for people and take it to their dorms. And so you have a partnership going. However, you do have to be careful here because technically speaking, in most states, if it is going to be recognized as a partnership, you have to file essentially a statement. We have begun this partnership. It's the problem here is, though, that if you don't do that, you are exposed to a slightly different set of, well, slightly. It's slight in a way, but it's dramatic in a way. Slightly different set of exposures to liabilities. In a general partnership, you are still all at risk. The two of you make your money, you get to keep it, divvy it up, and report it as your ordinary income. You pay your expenses. So you still have a lot of freedom, except you have to put up with him, and he can be an asshole sometimes. He tells me the same thing about you. So there is a limit on your freedom that way. The two of you have a certain accountability to one another. Now, the other part of it is also that you're all at risk, jointly and severally. If one of you screws up, both of you are on the hook for the screw up. You're catering a party. You run over a couple of the people. Hey, they were drunk. What can I say? They were ugly too. That's not going to help. They're still going to go right through your truck and any other assets you had in that business, and they are going to clean your clocks. And you can't stop them unless you've got good lawyers and some insurance, too. The thing of it is, though, that in a partnership, like a sole proprietorship, there's one thing that will end the arrangement. Not short of bankruptcy, we're getting wiped out. There's one thing that will always end a sole proprietorship and end a partnership. It's this minor thing called death. If you die, your company is over. That nice little DBA you had, one guy and his truck, it's gone. It's over. It's dead. Just like you are. The difference, well, that's not a difference. Neither of you might go to heaven. But the thing is, and in a partnership, if one of you dies, that's the end of the partnership right there. It's over. That partnership closes. Because if you file that as a formal partnership, you named yourselves, each of you as the general partners. When one of you dies, the partnership by definition cannot go on. Now, there are technically some ways that you can have a survivorship. Normally, what would happen is you would create some kind of an agreement. He has got a wife. She's very good in business, and he dies. Circumstances are a little bit, you know, but he dies. Now, technically, you might be able to reform a partnership, in the image of the old partnership with his wife in his stead. But technically speaking, the original partnership is dead permanently, forever. In other words, getting out of a partnership is easy if you're willing to die. Otherwise, getting out of a partnership might not be that easy. Now, what I've talked about here is a general partnership. Your liabilities are shared. And whatever is left over, you get to share as well. It has a finite life that is the life of the shortest living partner, the partner who lives the shortest amount of time. And just like a sole proprietorship, you are all at risk, jointly and severally, in a general partnership. And just like a sole proprietorship, there's a lot of work. It's going to be hard for you as a sole proprietor or you as a partnership to hire people. People are kind of I guess you could probably pay some people on the side or something like that. But having a formal employment relationship, not likely. You're going to be on your own. You're going to bear the burden of the work in your shop. And you two are going to bear the burden of work in your shop. That's just the way it's going to be. Getting employees to work for you, all that kind of stuff is going to be a little bit complicated. There's another kind of partnership out there. This is the one with which I have personally more experience. It's what's called the limited partnership. Now, a limited partnership has at least one general partner and at least one limited partner. And there will be a limited partnership agreement. Now, the general partner will manage the partnership, or the general partners will manage the partnership, and they will bear all risk. The limited partners do not bear all the risk. Their risk is limited by their contract in the limited partnership. And also, they are not allowed to get involved in the management of the partnership. They are limited to their investment, and that is all. One that I was involved in, one of several that I was involved in over the years, limited partnerships have limited lifespans. There is a project. The general partners get together. Okay, we are going to need money. So what they do is they raise money by selling limited partnership units to well-heeled investors. So I would set up a limited partnership. And in that limited partnership, you and I would be the general partners, and we would have the great ideas. We would do all the management, all the work, all the stuff like that. And then we would say, okay, we need $100,000 for this project. And so we would go out there and let's say we would sell 10 $10,000 limited partnerships to sophisticated, well-heeled investors or something like that. And we go out there, we do this, and you have to be careful about how you do this because you are going to be soliciting money from people, and states don't like it if you do that without at least some sense of the laws that are involved. Sometimes it's a very complicated process raising the money. But we get our money together. We run the project. We pay the limited partners as per the agreement. We keep the top on it. Usually we keep the lion's share if there's going to be a lion's share. And then once the project is over, we move on. The partnership closes according to schedule, and we hope. And then you might go on and do another one. One in which I was involved some years back was setting up low-income housing for the elderly, limited partnerships, where essentially we would form the partnership, then use federal and state low-interest and no-interest loans to build low-income housing for the elderly, literally, little apartments. They were nice apartments, don't get me wrong, but they were for older people with limited money. And we would get these limited partners to put their money in with the low-interest and zero-interest loans that we were getting from the government for this purpose. And then we would run the partnership. We would get the housing built, and we would let it run. Now, the interesting thing about these limited partnerships is that every year we would provide our investors with a couple of tax statements. And I promise you that there was not one time in all of the time that I did these that we ever sent the investors a dime. Every year we sent them a couple of different statements recognizing their losses. Losses as far as we were losing money in the partnership, and also because once these were built, they were depreciating at a very nice rate, according to accounting rules. So they were taking losses out the butt. And these wealthy investors, doctors, optometrists, lawyers, dentists, they loved what we did. They were always waiting for another one of these. Why? They just loved what we did. Each one of them put in $25,000. And we would run these through the income cycle, the depreciation cycle. I wish I could remember. I think it was like we'd run one of them for 10 years. It took less than a year to build this thing. And then we'd run the partnership for 10 years until we'd exhausted everything that we could do. And then that was the partnership would close. And we would tell those investors every year, you have lost money. Yeah, sometimes quite a bit. $5,000, $7,000 in losses. In the first years, $3,000, $2,000 in the back years, lost money. Why would they love themselves our limited partnerships? You know? Because they put in $25,000. These were people who were making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And then every year for years, we'd send them a loss, which they could write off against their active income. Oh, I made $150,000 last year, this limited partnership, I can take off $8,000. That was money they saved on taxes year after year after year. $25,000 for them, what they saved in taxes by taking these paper losses, they were paper losses, was way in excess of their $25,000 investment. They were tax havens. They were shields for taxes. And so it isn't the case that partnerships have to be profitable to be awesome. And when I finally left doing that, there was much consternation. Part of it was that the budget cuts at the federal level were finally killing off those low-income housing for the elderly, low-interest and no-interest loans. But there are still plenty of opportunities out there like that. And many times you get investors, and I won't say this is always the case, but quite frequently you'll get investors and they're not in it for you to send them money. They're in it for the losses that they can write off against their taxable income. That's just the reality of it. And that's one of the things you have to watch out for. You have to make sure that you're not getting amateurs who are being your limited partners. You have to make sure that you are not getting people who might have a little money as your limited partners. You need people who make a lot of money so that they are in the top marginal income tax bracket. So when they take a loss, that's a fat amount of tax they don't have to pay. That's why you have to be a little cautious when you do the, not a little, you have to be seriously cautious. You can't have someone, Ma and Pa Kettle, who have $25,000 kicking around and they'll throw it into this because they're never going to see their $25,000 again. Their taxes are so low as it is that they're not going to, taking that loss isn't worth their aggravation, isn't worth it to them. But there you are. Now, limited partnerships are all over the place. They are so common out there. And you can see them in everything from apartment complexes to even into movies. Many indie movies and even mainstream movies are done in limited partnership fashion. You put together a limited partnership, get the money together, do your movie, and then move on from there. And if it's a winner, your investors make bucks. If it's a loser, they get a tax write-off. And also they get this other thing, which is very fun when I did one indie movie limited partnership. They get bragging rights. Yeah, I invested in a movie. I won't tell you what kind of movie it was, but the kind of movies that these were very popular in are not considered the nicest movies. But they are actually a very, very active place for limited partnerships. And as a business, it's just as good. The money there is just as good as any other money. Now let me take you on to the ultimate pinnacle. To the pinnacle of enterprise. It is the corporation. The corporation. A corporation is an entity that is separate from and recognized by law as separate from the owners. In your sole proprietorship, the law recognizes no difference between you and your little business. Same with your partnership. There is no difference, really, at the end of the day, between you and your business. But a corporation is recognized by law as its own entity. Its liabilities belong to it, not to you. If you are an owner of a corporation, and that corporation does something that gets it sued, or that it has bills that it can't pay, the collectors, the debtors, cannot get to you unless you have screwed the pooch and destroyed the corporate veil. There is a corporate veil there, and a court is going to recognize and respect that corporate veil. You would have to deliberately give the court cause to pierce the corporate veil. In other words, using the corporate credit card, the corporation's credit card for your shopping or for your night at the movies. If you do that, all bets are off. But as long as you completely respect that the corporation is its own animal, its own being, for lack of a better word, its own person under the law, you're not at risk. So your corporation runs over that. So if you run over that dog, you didn't run over the dog if you're a corporation. The corporation ran over the dog. Okay? That's why one of the things that is a little bit of a disturbing thought, for some people it hits you over the head when you begin your business life after you've gotten your degree and all that. Some people, it just never quite hits in the same way. But when you work for a corporation, that corporation isn't you. That corporation isn't the chief executive officer. That corporation isn't the body of the workers. That corporation isn't even the shareholders who come to the shareholder meetings. It's its own animal. It's its own thing. It is an entity that is respected and recognized under the law. In fact, there was a rather dramatic little tension last year when the Supreme Court of the United States recognized a quite expansive right to free speech of corporations, saying that we cannot limit their campaign contributions because that would be limiting their speech. And corporations have the right to free speech under the Constitution. Well, there are a lot of people who were really upset about that, including President Obama, who in last year's State of the Union looked right at the Supreme Court justices sitting there listening to him, and he bitched them out about it. And one of them, who was one of the justices who was on the majority that said that this was the way it is, free speech for corporations, he sat there mouthing, "Not true, not true," shaking his head. And of course, the obvious dignified response to him is, "You asshole, yes, that is true. You just recognize corporations as having a free speech right that is quite expansive." However, where the liberals and the leftists were just pissing all over themselves about this is not actually correct. That this was some dramatic thing. No. The Supreme Court, since the 1970s, had been inching forward in recognizing rights of corporations, recognizing more and more that they are, quote-unquote, persons under the law. And as such, they must have constitutional protections in the same way as a human being type of person might have. And if we do not let them have this, we can get into some problems with the question of how are they to function efficiently in a world where they do not have at least certain rights, right of due process, for example, or the right of speech. Look, if you're in a corporation, did you know that as a corporation, in your advertising, you can lie? Did you know that? You can't go crazy lying, but you can do something that we euphemistically call puffing. Kind of overstating the position. Cleaner than clean, whiter than white. Well, that's bull crap. But at the same time, we can say it. We're allowed to. As a corporation, you can do that. You can lie. And you see, did you know that you can lie too? You can't lie under oath. You probably wouldn't want to lie to a grand jury or even to a police officer. But at the same time, you can lie. Have you ever lied? Did you know that you're allowed to?
No.
Yeah. You could tell a date that you're actually related to Charlie Sheen. I don't know. Or Justin Bieber. Yes. Okay, maybe not. You carved the meat for Lady Gaga's outfit. You took care of the chickens that laid the egg for her latest ridiculous stunt. Okay, or not. You are the body double for some of those guys who are the muscle men in those men's health magazines. Yes, you are. You can lie. See, that's a free speech, right? You go overboard, and obviously you might be able to get sued. But it's actually a right of people in their free speech rights. And therefore, we recognize that corporations will have a similar right to overstate a position. But let me get down to the specifics here. You decide that you want to create a corporation. You want to separate your ownership from the liabilities of that entity. Recognize first that as an owner, you would have, if there is profit, you or money that is coming in, you as the owner or owners would have the residual claim. The debt holders will have the prior claim. So in other words, you have to pay your debts in a timely manner according to your contracts with your debt holders. And if there is any money left over, you get to keep it. If there is no money left over, well, you're out. If there isn't enough money to pay your debt holders, the debt holders have recourse to the corporation, but not to you. You'll have to decide, okay, where should I form this corporation? Corporations are state entities. Corporations are not federal entities. They are state entities. This parallels, in fact, our own citizenship. We are citizens of a state. We are also dual citizens of the United States of America. But we are actually, in many ways, first citizens of our state. Now, our Constitution is set up so that the federal government has supremacy in all matters where it makes a claim to supremacy. But that's challenged all the time. There's a dynamic tension. Your citizenship in a state might actually afford you more protections than the Constitution does, depending upon what state it is. So don't just keep saying, well, the Constitution of the United States. Think about your own state's Constitution, because you are recognized as a living entity by your state, actually not by the federal government. Your birth certificate is a state certificate, not a federal certificate. You gain citizenship automatically in the United States by virtue of the fact that you are a citizen of one of the states of that United States, but your birth certificate is a state document. Now, a corporation will be a state entity as well. You choose a state in which to form your corporation. That will be your state of domicile. D-O-M-I-C-I-L-E. That will be your state of domicile. Any other state in which you do business will recognize you as a foreign corporation in that state. And you say, well, I'd obviously start my form my corporation in this state because I live here and I'll do my business here. That's not how you think about it. Oftentimes, many of the corporations I formed in Delaware, in the state of Delaware. Why Delaware? When I hardly ever went to Delaware. I never ran a business. I never made a dime in Delaware. Why did I form them in Delaware? The reason is simple. Delaware has an extraordinarily mature business law. It has a body of corporation law that is sophisticated, old, and has a court system. Its chancery system is completely key to understanding business. All the rules, all the doctrines, all of the legal precedents, the judges, quote unquote, judges in the chancery system are second to none. They know corporate law. So if I want a place where they understand something like, for example, the business judgment rule, I can assume that this is a really good place to have my corporation domiciled. By the way, the business judgment rule is kind of an interesting rule. In business, you can really screw up. I promise you. As the CEO, president of a corporation, I mean, you can screw up so epically that you'll be featured on failblog.org. I mean, it's just amazing what you can do. But you see, sometimes the owners, the shareholders, well, they'll want to sue your ass for what you've done. Well, you lost money. Yeah, well, you tried doing this, you know? And they'll sue. Now, the business judgment rule is a rule that says, look, the people who made the decisions at the top of this corporation, they were doing it in the best interest. They did it with good judgment. Maybe it wasn't the best judgment, but it was business judgment. And unless you can really show that it was unbelievably bad or that they were personally getting something out of a bad decision, you leave the corporation alone. It made a mistake. You're all waving your flag saying, hero, hero, when they make money, and then you piss all over yourselves when they blow it. Knock it off. You can't sue. That's the business judgment rule. It's a really simple way of saying it, but it's a business judgment rule. Okay, so I would want a state where the courts recognize all of the nuances of law. Delaware is a good state. Pennsylvania is a good state. I mean, there are a number of states. I always wanted to form a corporation in Hawaii just so I could hold the annual shareholder meetings on Oahu, you know, make the corporation pay for it. Never did get around to that. But and on the other hand, though, there are states that are actually, I would not form a corporation there if I had a gun to my head. They're hostile. And I won't mince words about it. They're just damn hostile. They tax the crap out of you for just how many shares you got outstanding. They're constantly bitching at you if you're trying to raise a little money and all this kind of stuff. You know, the hell with states like that. I don't need the aggravation. Now, so you're going to form your corporation in a state. Now, what will happen is that you will, in that state, you will write what are called the Articles of Incorporation. Now in my day, when I wrote these, and I don't do this anymore, note that for anyone who wants to kick my ass for practicing law without a license, bite me, I don't do it anymore. Statute of limitations is over. These were actually a one-page document. It was essentially, here's the name of our corporation. Here is where it will be located for business purposes. This is the name of the person you send court documents to. We call that the statutory agent for service of process. Usually it's not someone in the corporation. You pay someone to just take any court's process that can't come in. This is how many shares absolute this corporation is divided into. I would usually form a corporation with like 100 million shares. Most of the shares were obviously not issued. I had those in reserve so that I could sell them to raise money later in stock offerings. I'd hand out some to the founders of the corporation and all that. Maybe a million to each of the five founders. Okay, 200,000 to you. But but the vast majority of those shares you usually don't do anything with. Right away, those are your sort of like your reserves so that you can make public offerings of common stock or whatever. Or you might also have other classes of stock too. I don't recommend that. You declare a par value, maybe a penny, a tenth of a cent, something like that on the stock, which you'll see that in accounting if you haven't taken accounting yet. But one way or the other, you create this set of articles of incorporation. Now, one thing that will come in that those articles is you'll make a statement that says that the powers of the incorporators will be dissolved upon the filing of these articles. And then the corporation from there will be governed by the officers and directors, whose jobs will be described in a document called the bylaws. The bylaws are essentially all of the rules of how the corporation works in terms of the names and titles and positions and duties of the various individuals who will be the directors and officers. It also gives life to how things are done at the very top level of the corporation. I used to work with bylaws. There is an art form in the old bylaws. I had a corporation that was actually formed in the 1930s. The bylaws were meticulous and precise so that any dispute, any question, okay, well, is this the treasurer's job or is this the secretary's job? Who's this? You could look in the bylaws. Ah, right there, that said. Okay, what does the stock certificate of the corporation look like? In some cases, they would describe that in detail down to the font. It was sort of like the underlying neural system of the corporation that could always be gone back to. But anyway, in the Articles of Incorporation, you'll say the incorporators, what their jobs were in getting this whole thing together, as soon as we file this with the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation, those incorporators' job is done. And now the corporation is under the control of the bylaws. Now, you file this, and I'm talking here old style, and I can't tell you that this is how it's still done in any given state. But the way we would do it is we would get these bylaws together. The incorporators would sign their signature. I'm sorry, the Articles of Incorporation. Each of the incorporators would sign it, and then we would, in triplicate, send it to the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation. In other words, if I were forming a corporation in Delaware, I would send it to the Secretary of State of the State of Delaware. And then, as long as it was in order, that you didn't screw up anything in the Articles of Incorporation, the Secretary of State would stamp those articles. And you would get back one of those three that you had sent. Now, that stamp doesn't mean that the Secretary of State approves your corporation. The appropriate term is qualifies. The Secretary of State qualifies the corporation. And in so doing, has just recognized the birth of a legal entity, a thing that is separate from its owners, the shareholders. The state now recognizes this as a legal entity that functions under its own bylaws in accordance with the applicable laws of that state and any other state in which it does business and with the federal government. So in other words, you are taking a very serious thing. I found it was funny because in my days of consulting, I would get calls from like random people. Well, we'd like to form a corporation here and get started with this here business we got going here. I didn't want to hear from them. Sometimes I get a recommendation. Look, you've got to sit them down, talk to them, get them so that they understand what's going on. This would be given to me by someone else who wanted to work with me in a corporate kind of thing. You'd have to explain to them, no, we're not going to just sit down, slap out a corporation so you can get down to business. You recognize that what we have done here is monumental. We have created a legal entity separate from ourselves. It's just like if you had created a baby. In fact, in some ways, it's much more significant than if you created a baby. The worst that a baby can do is shit its diaper. Okay? The worst that a corporation can do is unimaginable. Ask the people of Bhopal, India, where a leak of chlorine gas wiped out an entire ghetto of thousands of people. Ask the people around Three Mile Island. Ask the people of a lot of places where corporations have screwed up so badly that people have died, people have been disfigured for life. Ask the people who have to go to wars for corporations for their profits. That doesn't mean it's wrong to start a war if you're a corporation, if you need a profit. It just means that you've got to take it really damn seriously what you're doing. So when I have someone, well, we're going to start ourselves a corporation here. No, you're going to sit down and understand that this is a grave responsibility that you are taking on. Now, once you get those articles of incorporation back, the first thing that you should do is apply to the federal government on form SS-9 for an FEIN, a Federal Employee Identification Number. They have a fast-track process where you can fill out the form, call them on the phone, they'll ask you for some of the information off the form, they'll issue you the FEIN right there over the phone, and then you fax them and send the hard copy of the full form. And they will give you, the federal government will give you an FEIN. In other words, it's a corporate equivalent of a Social Security number. Just like when a baby is born, first the birth certificate, then the Social Security number. It's just like that, except that this thing is not a human being. Once you have those articles of incorporation qualified by the Secretary of State, a state of incorporation, you got your FEIN, you're on your way. Now you are the stewards, you are the owners of a legal entity. You are not that legal entity. You can't walk in there and say, well, I want this. No. If you are an officer or a director of that corporation, what you do is for the benefit of that corporation, not I. We have lost our way in many corporations at the top levels in this day and age where we hand out huge executive bonuses and all that kind of stuff, worried about, well, he might leave if we don't pay him an extra $100 million, bullshit. The corporation will survive whether or not we coddle some person who says, I all the time. It will survive or it will die based upon the merits of the dedication of the people who are there to maximize the value of the shareholders. Everyone in the corporation who is named in those bylaws in one way or another is there for one purpose only, to maximize the value of the shareholders, and that means to ensure that that corporation not only survives but does well. After you have formed this corporation, you can take a couple of routes. Now, here's the problems with corporations. Okay, upside. You as an owner are not liable for the bills of the corporation. The debt holders cannot come through and get you unless you really, as I said before, screw the pooch. On the other hand, there are and other benefits of a corporation too. It's going to be easier for you to go to a bank if you need working capital loans or something like that. It's going to be easier to go out there and get investors to get involved in your company because you can issue them stock or things like that. On the downside, it's complex. From square one going on down through, every day you are shepherding something that is separate from yourself. It's not just a matter of, well, I feel like I could get up and do some loads in my truck, or I'd do some catering today. In a corporation, you are there. If you are the one in charge of maximizing shareholder value, you're on the clock. It's complex, the workload is quite difficult, and also, you are bound by laws. Your corporation is bound by laws, and they will hold you, if you're in a position of responsibility, they will hold you, those laws will, to account if you screw up on behalf of that corporation. We'll get into that later in the topic of agency and fiduciary duties. But at this point, you can take a couple of different routes. One problem with a corporation is that you've paid all your bills and you get down to this line called earnings before taxes. And then you have to pay tax to the government on your earnings. And then after that line, you pay your taxes, you've got your net income. Only at the net income line do you have money that's available to the shareholders, to the owners. So let's say that I come down and I've got $100,000 earnings before taxes. Let's say $100,000. Let's say my corporate tax rate is 25%. So I will take out $25,000 in taxes and I've got $75,000, and that's my net income. That is the money that is the residual amount on which the shareholders have a claim. They have the right to this. You can either give it to them in dividends, or you can plow it back into the corporation to build the corporation. Or you can do a combination of those. Let's say that we give to you, the only owner of the corporation. Let's say we give you $20,000 just to keep you happy. The other $55,000 we're going to plow back into the corporation. So I'm going to give a dividend out of $20,000. You get that dividend, you have to pay tax on it. You pay tax on it. Do you see? Double taxation. That's kind of nasty. You see it? Corporations, the owners of a corporation face a double tax. And that double tax exists only if there's a dividend that is being paid. Arguably, you have to give dividends just to shut your shareholders up. But the real question, and you will get this again from me in a finance class, is why are you giving dividends to the shareholders when you could plow it back into the corporation and build shareholder value so their stock price goes up? You do the dividends almost just like a signal, hey, we're healthy enough, we can give away a little money, double taxed and all that. It's far better if you talk about it in terms of this is something that we do just as a necessary evil. Most of the company's profit we will put back into the corporation, and in the long run, the shareholders will love us more because their stock just keeps going up and up and up in value because we're investing in new projects all the time and increasing their shareholder value that way. There's another form of corporation out there. This is what I just described there as a C corp. There's another kind of corporation out there. You can elect through the IRS S corp status instead of C corp. Now, an S-corp, there are everything is taxed only at the level of the shareholder. Essentially, you just distribute the income, and it's taxed just once at the level of the owners of the corporation. Now, there are a couple of downsides to an S-corporation. Although you don't get the double taxation thing, a couple of downsides. It's not easy. You can't have a whole lot of owners. There's a limit on how many owners you can have in an S-corp. It's also a lot harder to do stock offerings to raise new money. An S-corp is really a better thing if you want to form a corporation, but you don't want that corporation's scale of ownership to become huge, and you don't see that you are going to need to raise money through public offerings of common stock. Because in S-corp configuration, you can't do things like that. At least it's really hard to bring money to the table like that. So S-corps do have their advantages, but at the same time recognize that an S-corp is only for a kind of corporation where you would not ever have a whole bunch of owners, and you would not have a lot of needs to go out there and raise new capital through equity offerings. You can certainly raise money through debt. You just borrow money. But an S Corp, you can't go out there and get new owners and all that kind of stuff like a normal C Corp could. You'll get a lot more about this if you take my Finance FIL 240 course. I go through a lot more about stock and stock offerings and all that kind of stuff and what corporations can and can't do and the laws that govern them. But know this, the corporation is a great, great innovation because what it allows us to do is to take on more risk than we would otherwise. Have you ever noticed all the building that goes on around us, all the businesses that start and all the businesses that fail? There's such a vibrance of activity in a capitalist country like this. We have all these places we can go and do something that is absolutely wonderful. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's called shopping. I love it. I'm a shopping hoe. I'll admit it, you know. But all these buildings, places to live, places to park, all the places that we can go to shop, to watch great movies, to be entertained in one way or another. A lot of that has to do with the fact that there are entrepreneurs out there who are willing to do this because there is a bottom on the risk that they are bearing. They are not going to lose their souls if they start a business and it fails. That gives me a little bit more bravery. Not a little bit, it can give me a lot more bravery if I know that over time I can work to grow this corporation, but I don't have to fear starting it because of the possibility that I would be wiped out personally. That allows us to do a lot more things and experiment a lot more with different business models, with different business, just basic business ideas than we would if this corporate form of enterprise were not there. So whether or not you're ever going to be a business person on your own, it's worth it for you to know these different things that can be done. Now, not every business is made for a corporation. Don't get me wrong about that. Some things, like I said, I've got corporations and I've got sole proprietorships. It all depends on what you're trying to do and what the risks are that are involved. But at the end of the day, most of you will work for the man, at least for part of your life, and you will probably work in a corporate environment, in a corporation. This gives you an idea of what the thing really is that you're working for. You're working not for your boss. You're not working for the guy over you or the woman above you. You're working for a legal entity that lives forever, theoretically. Corporations don't die. And at the same time, since they don't die, they don't have a soul. Keep that in mind. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.